The writer Judith Ortiz Cofer was born in rural Puerto Rico in 1952 to teenaged parents. To better provide for the family, her father gave up his dreams of more education and became a career military man, moving them to Paterson, New Jersey. When he was stationed elsewhere for months at a time, his homesick wife would take the family back to the island, regardless of the time of year. This divide between English and Spanish in both schools and communities created experiences that shaped Cofer's life and work.
There is a duality in my person and in the choices I make on a daily basis. And of course, also politically, I have chosen to live in this country. And therefore, you know, I am no longer the kind of Puerto Rican that my mother is. Her destiny and her island's destiny are one. It is as if the island were her body. And with me, it's a matter of the heart.
We'll explore more of the heart of the late Judith Ortiz Cofer, a multi-genre writer of poetry, fiction, and memoir, who's written, edited, and contributed to dozens of books. She also inspired thousands of students along the way before retiring as Emeritus Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Georgia, 3 years before her December 2016 death. In this archive interview for National Hispanic Heritage Month, this influential writer talks about Corazon's Cafe in prose and poetry as she reads from her book, The Latin Deli. So stay with us for this past American voice of New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Though Judith Ortiz Cofer spent most of her childhood divided between Puerto Rico and New Jersey, the 1968 riots in the barrios of Paterson prompted her father to find a safer place to live, so they moved to Georgia when she was 16. In 1970, she enrolled at Augusta College and the next year married fellow student and Georgia native John Cofer. Like her father, she was still a teenager, but she went on to have a daughter and finish her education. Her young family moved to Florida, where she was in graduate school when her father, who had recently retired from the Navy, was killed in a car wreck in 1976. Her mother then moved back to Puerto Rico for good, so the split between the mainland and the island continued for Judith. After a decade in Florida, the Cofers returned to rural Georgia to the farm that had been in her husband's family for generations. He taught high school math while she straddled another divide between living there and teaching in Athens, Georgia. Despite the distinct cultural differences within her life experiences, Judith Ortiz Cofer always saw the world in universal terms.
Frankly, I'm more concerned with the internal lives of people, and I'm very well aware that the cultural element is just an extra, and that you can substitute the Puerto Rican girl, hopefully can be substituted by African-American girl, American girl, or boy. I mean, it's a human thing. My culture simply adds another dimension to my work. So I don't think my work is about being Puerto Rican so much as it is about being a human being in this time and place.
Well, it's being a human being, but if you break it down about being a woman, and if you break
it down about
being a woman raised in the customs of Puerto Rico and America and having one foot, you know, on the mainland and on the island is, I guess, a better way to describe it. But you know what I love about The Latin Deli? If I can just talk about this book a little bit. It's a combination of stories, of poetry, of what seem to be personal essays. It's a wonderful book because it does give you a glimpse into you as a writer, but also into Paterson, New Jersey, and this culture and the, what is it called, El Building?
El Building.
El Building. And all the people who fill this building, you know. I just love some of the characters. And then the stories were on the island and, and would take you back to the mainland and to this town. I think one of my favorite stories in here is filled with some great characters, and it's way, way, way too long to read, but it's Corazon's Cafe.
Corazon's Cafe.
Because we don't have time to read that whole thing, there's the opening piece to In fact, it's the title piece for this book, The Latin Deli. And I got the distinct feeling that the character in here was an older version of the character in Corazon's Cafe.
You make an A in the class. Actually, the story is that the poem, The Latin Deli, was written years before the story, but the woman, who was really a woman in a little bodega that sold Puerto Rican food, fascinated me so much because she acted as if she was the spiritual leader for the community. Just because she sold us Bustelo coffee and we needed her. And she fascinated me so much that I couldn't stop thinking about her. And so I started imagining a life for her. And I called her Corazon because Corazon means heart. And I made up this entire life based on a couple of meetings with this woman at a bodega. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The woman in the bodega didn't turn out to be exactly Corazon, but she was the genesis. Yeah. She was the reason that I wrote Corazon Café.
I could see it blooming out of that, actually. I had a feeling that's what you
had done. That's really nice because, you know, if people notice it, not many people have told me. I've told them. You know, that is the same person. And I was always fascinated when I was growing up, too, with the idea that everyone sought solace at the bodega. And there was always a man or a woman who owned the bodega, and he smelled like home. He smelled like the produce, you know, and the people came to him for comfort and for advice and, you know.
To play dominoes.
To play dominoes in the back, you know, to gossip. And in my story, I wanted it to be a woman. And to be called heart, to be called corazón, because the bodega was the heart of the barrio.
Yeah, and it's like a little corner grocery, right, basically?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Where they're selling all sorts of items from the homeland.
That's right, that's right. And it's usually just what they can afford to rent, usually a hole in the wall. But it doesn't matter. You know, my mother would walk blocks and blocks and blocks to the bodega, even though we had an AMP next door.
Right.
Because the AMP was not, you know, it was well lit and sanitized and everything else. It didn't have the feeling of home that the bodega had with its bins and the plantains hanging and all that. And you don't see that very much, but there is one in Atlanta, actually. They're all called El Rinconcito Latino. Everywhere I go, I've been to all these, you know, states, and if it's a large enough city, they'll have, Rincón means corner, of course. Rinconcito means the little Latin corner.
Oh,
El Rinconcito Latino, you know.
Well, I would love it if you would read this poem for us, because
okay.
I think it shows your characterization within poems, too. Judith Ortiz Cofer reads the title poem from her collection, The Latin Deli, and this is New Letters on the Air.
The Latin Deli in Ars Poetica. Presiding over a Formica counter, plastic mother and child magnetized to the top of an ancient register. The heady mix of smells from the open bins of dried codfish. The green plantains hanging in stalks like votive offerings. She is the patroness of exiles, a woman of no age who was never pretty, who spends her days selling canned memories while listening to the Puerto Ricans complain that it would be cheaper to fly to San Juan than to buy a pound of Bustelo coffee here, and to Cubans perfecting their speech of a glorious return to Havana, where no one has been allowed to die and nothing to change until then, to Mexicans who pass through talking lyrically of dólares to be made in El Norte, all wanting the comfort of spoken Spanish, to gaze upon the family portrait of her plain, wide face, her ample bosom resting on her plump arms, her look of maternal interest as they speak to her and each other of their dreams and their disillusions, how she smiles understanding when they walk down the narrow aisles of her store reading the labels of packages aloud as if they were the names of lost lovers, suspiros, merengues, the stale candy of everyone's childhood. She spends her days slicing jamón y queso and wrapping it in wax paper tied with string, plain ham and cheese that would cost less at the AMP. But it would not satisfy the hunger of the fragile old man lost in the folds of his winter coat, who brings her lists of items that he reads to her like poetry, or the others whose needs she must divine, conjuring up products from places that now exist only in their hearts, close ports she must trade with.
That's the beginning of the book of prose and poetry by the late Judith Ortiz Cofer called The Latin Deli, published by Norton & Company in 1995 and reissued in 2010 by the University of Georgia Press. The book also contains the O. Henry Prize-winning short story first published in the Georgia Review called Nada. For New Letters on the Air, I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with the writer in 1998 about the book, the influence of family and students, and the poem you just heard, The Latin Deli and Ars Poetica.
You know what was really fun about reading this poem, because I like this character here, but when I got to the story, which is about three-fourths of the way through the book, it was almost as if I had met this character and then somehow I had gotten into a box of old photographs or something and was able to discover something about her life. And there are several characters that kind of weave in and out of your writing that way. I noticed when I was going from this, your grandfather appears, of course, and he was a poet and a house painter.
Yes, he was the artist. My grandmother was the matriarch, you know, so when people say, well, your grandmother influenced you, and I said, well, she taught me about strength of character and how to tell a good lie well, you know. And but my papa was a gentle, you know, a man who wanted to be a poet, and he painted houses and built houses for a living, but he also composed music and poetry, very flowery. Poetry, mostly about the island and about his wife. And he was the gentle voice in my childhood who taught me about poetry.
Yeah.
So Mama is the center of strength. She's my muse for that. And Papa for gentleness and artistic soul, definitely. And you're right, even in my book that I wrote that has been marketed for young people called An Island Like You, Corazon makes a cameo appearance. She still has the bodega, and it's where the kids go when they need to find a place to meet because they want to do something about putting on a play. And so, of course, Corazon is there. And several of the characters from my novel that then migrated to the Latin Deli, because, see, in my novel, El Building was born in my novel. Then I burned it down because the plot needed it, you know, and I could do it. And then when I started the Latin Deli, I realized that the characters needed a place to live. So I brought El Building back because I can. Of course, I said the stories before I burned the building down. No one even cares or has asked me, but out of a sense of integrity and duty, like Nada, for example, is set in during the Vietnam years before El Building was burned down, but the characters live in El Building. Mm-hmm. And some of the characters that appear in The Line of the Sun appear in the Latin Deli, and then now in An Island Like You. And that is because what I'm trying to do is to construct a world, a little world, where the people can interact more naturally.
Yeah, much the way Faulkner did and created his world there.
Right, we don't want him to roll over in his grave by mentioning my name and his in the same breath. I'm an English teacher, remember, but if I could do what he did, I would die happy, definitely. But it makes it more manageable, you know, really, when I can imagine one place and people interacting or at least coming together occasionally like we did in my neighborhood when I was growing up.
You know, your writing is very visual for me. It conjured all sorts of images, and I certainly could see El Building. I could certainly see that.
Oh, well, I'm glad.
Well, we've already mentioned Faulkner with your name, but there's an essay in here, too, that I have to mention with Virginia Woolf, because you can't help but think about having a room of your own to write when you're reading your essay that's called 5 a.m., Writing as a Ritual.
Right.
And I think this is a wonderful, it's a short little piece, but it gives a real insight into your world as a writer and how you created a room of your own without making it necessarily any one room.
Right, and there, every word is true. The essay was written to answer the question of a group of students who wanted to publish an issue where they asked writers how they came to declare themselves writers, how they came to make that decision. And I said the first thing I had to do was to find a place and a time to do it. I mean, it wasn't just like I woke up one morning and said, guess what, everybody, I'm an artist and everybody has to give me the time I need. By the time I started writing.
Which was when?
Well, I always wanted to write and needed to, but I got married young, continued to go to school, had a child early. And so it was not until I finished graduate school, my child started preschool, and I was teaching on three different campuses, you know, in the usual adjunct faculty slave labor years. And by the time I finished my day, it had finished me. And so I was in my late 20s, and I started getting up at 5 a.m. because I discovered that my family didn't want me at that hour. And the phone wasn't ringing, and, you know, the house was quiet, and it took setting two alarm clocks to get up at that hour, and I gave myself 2 hours, and then around 7:30, Tanya was up, and the day had started, but by that time, I had written my page or 2 pages, and I wrote the novel that way, 2 pages a day over 3.5 years.
Wow, that's an amazing thing.
Well, it was the only way. And when people, especially women, they say, well, if I had the time like you, I'd write books. And I said, I don't have the time. I've never had the time. You know, even now, my daughter is 24, and I have control, supposedly, of my day. My duties have multiplied, teaching, traveling. I have a dozen graduate students whose needs, you know, I have to meet as far as reading their manuscripts and meeting with them. I still have to get up before anybody else does and before the phone starts ringing or before things happen. So the world is not going to give you the time, not if you're involved in life, you know, and I don't want to give up my daughter, my family, my husband, or my students, or my teaching. So I have to find a room of my own that is mainly made up of 2 hours of time when the world leaves me alone. And so women will come up and say, you know, well, when my children start college or when I retire, I say, by that time, you won't feel the urge, the need, the immediacy. Writing is something that you nurture over many, many years, and the better you become at it, the more you need it. So it's not heroic. Believe me, I hate getting up in the morning.
I was about to say you don't want to give up your family, your daughter, your students, but you do give up your sleep.
Yes, and my social life. Yeah, I have to. I have to go to bed early to get up early.
No wonder she wrote The Woman Who Slept with One Eye Open, the first essay in a collection edited with Marilyn Callett on women writers and the art of survival. Re-released in 2017 by the University of Georgia Press, that book is called Sleeping with One Eye Open. You're listening to an archived New Letters on the Air in honor of the late Judith Ortiz Cofer, who was inducted into the Georgia Writers Hall of Fame in 2010. For more on her process, here's her essay from the Latin Deli, 5 a.m., Writing as Ritual.
An act of will that changed my life from that of a frustrated artist waiting to have a room of my own and an independent income before getting down to business to that of a working writer. I decided to get up 2 hours before my usual time to set my alarm for 5 a.m. When people ask me how I started writing, I find myself describing the urgent need that I felt to work with language as a search. I did not know for a long time what I was looking for. Although I married at 19, had a child at 21, all the while going through college and graduate school and working part-time, it was not enough. There was something missing in my life that I came close to only when I turned to my writing. When I took a break from my thesis research to write a poem or an idea for a story on the flip side of an index card, it wasn't until I traced this feeling to its source that I discovered both the cause and the answer to my frustration. I needed to write. I showed my first efforts to a woman, a literary colleague, who encouraged me to mail them out. One poem was accepted for publication, and I was hooked. This bit of success is really the point where my problem began. Once I finished graduate school, I had no reason to stay at the library that extra hour to write poems. It was 1978. My daughter was 5 years old and in school during the day while I traveled the county, teaching freshman composition on 3 different campuses. Afternoons, I spent taking her to the ballet, tap, and every other socializing lesson her little heart desired. I composed my lectures on Florida's I-95, and that was all the thinking time I had. Does this sound like the typical superwoman's lament? To me, it meant being in a constant state of mild anxiety, which I could not really discuss with others. What was I to say to them? I need an extra hour to start a poem? Will someone please stop the world from spinning so fast? I did not have the privilege of attending a writer's workshop as a beginning writer. I came to writing instinctively, as a dowser finds an underground well. I did not know that I would eventually make a career out of writing books and giving readings of my work. The only models I knew were the unattainable ones. The first famous poet I met was Richard Eberhardt, so exalted and venerable that he might as well have been the Pope. All I knew at that time was that at 26 years of age, I felt spiritually deprived. Although I had all the things my women friends found sufficiently fulfilling in a woman's life plus more, I was also teaching, which is the only vocation I always knew I had. But I had found poetry, or it had found me, and it was demanding its place in my life. After trying to stay up late at night for a couple of weeks and discovering that there was not enough of me left after a full day of giving to others, I relented and did this odious thing. I set my alarm for 5. The first day, I shut it off because I could. I had placed it within arm's reach. The second day, I set 2 clocks, one on my night table as usual and one out in the hallway. I had to jump out of bed and run to silence it before my family was awakened and the effort nullified. This is when my morning writing ritual that I follow to this day began. I get up at 5 and put on a pot of coffee. Then I sit in my rocking chair and read what I did the previous day until the coffee is ready. I take 15 minutes to drink 2 cups of coffee while my computer warms up. Not that it needs to. I just like to see it glowing in the room where I sit in semi-darkness, its screen prompting, ready, ready whenever you are. When I'm ready, I write. Since that first morning in 1978, when I rose in the dark to find myself in a room of my own, with 2 hours belonging only to me ahead of me, 2 prime hours when my mind was still filtering my dreams, I have not made or accepted too many excuses for not writing. This apparently ordinary choice to get up early and to work every day forced me to come to terms with the discipline of art. I wrote my poems in this manner for nearly 10 years before my first book was published. When I decided to give my storytelling impulse full rein and write a novel, I divided my 2 hours, the first hour for poetry, the second for fiction, 2 pages minimum per day. Well or badly, I wrote 2 pages a day for 3.5 years. This is how my novel, The Line of the Sun, was finished. If I had waited to have the time, I would still be waiting to write my novel. My life has changed considerably since those early days when I was trying to be everything to everyone. My daughter is 18, actually 24 now. And in college, graduate school, not a ballerina, rockette, or horsewoman, but a disciplined student and a self-assured young person. Thus, I do not regret the endless hours of sitting in tiny chairs at the Rockette Academy of Dance, or of breathing the saturated air at the stables as I waited for her. She got out of her activity something like what I got out of getting up in the dark to work. The feeling that you're in control, on the saddle, on your toes. Empowerment is what the emerging artist needs to win for herself. And the initial sense of urgency to create can easily be dissipated because it entails making the one choice many people, especially women, in our society with its emphasis on the acceptable priorities, feel selfish about making, taking the time to create, stealing it from yourself if it's the only way.
The late Judith Ortiz Cofer, who received the 2011 Georgia Governor's Award in the Humanities. We just heard her essay, 5 a.m., Writing is Ritual, from her book, The Latin Deli, Prose and Poetry. This is New Letters on the Air. That's a very inspirational piece.
Thank you.
Piece.
Actually, I'm working on a series of those essays about the writing life. Not telling anyone how to write. It's not a how-to book, but basically how I have come to use life as the material for my art. And that doesn't include elephant hunting or many forays into Hollywood. But it means just taking what is offered to me on a daily basis, you know, and turning it into art so that there's no excuse. You know, it'd be nice to go to Italy to get inspiration, but you can belong to what I call the Emily Dickinson Travel Club. You sit in your room and see the world.
Now, I know that you were working on a second novel. Have you finished that, or are you still working on it?
I finished it this past summer, but I'm involved in so many projects that we've had to put a hold on it. We're hoping to get to the editing part of it sometime next year. As of now, it's called The Only Homeland. But I've learned that I announce a title, and then by the time the book comes out,
it may be
something else altogether.
Well, does L Building show up in that novel, too?
No, actually, it did, and then I took it out because I decided to set it in Puerto Rico during the Operation Bootstrap years, which was when the island changed completely, like from a rural, you know, agricultural-based society to a tourist. The novel is set in a urban area near San Juan during the late 1950s. I wanted to explore a different aspect of the Puerto Rican culture.
The past American voice of Judith Ortiz Cofer, recorded during Rockhurst University's 1998 Midwest Poet Series. The title essay of her 2000 book, Woman in Front of the Sun, on Becoming a Writer, was first published in New Letters magazine. Also, the title of her second novel did change. The Meaning of Consuelo was published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux in 2003. She completed 8 more books of poetry, fiction, and memoir, including Lessons from a Writer's Life, readings and resources for teachers and students. After 29 years of teaching at UGA, she retired in 2013 to go to Puerto Rico to nurse her mother, who was dying from lung cancer. Judith continued to deal with life through writing while working on her memoir, The Cruel Country, Notes for an Elegy, about the loss of her mother. She discovered she had cancer. That final book was published by the University of Georgia Press, and Judith Ortiz Cofer died the next year, on December 30, 2016, at her home outside Louisville, Georgia, at the age of 64. In November 2017, a special publication of the South Atlantic Review will honor this Latina literary pioneer. Listen for more in an upcoming National Hispanic Heritage Month program, along with some history from Judith about Puerto Rico and the U.S. This show was originally produced by New Letters Magazine at UMKC with Margaret Smith and Laura Spencer. Updates thanks to Claire Verbeck and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.